to country does. Sound practice. Like I say, sound mind and sound body. Balanced practice. Play three sports. Sound practices academically. Very good professors who care. A philosophical underpinning, you know, of what the school is about. So here we come after the 60s and coming into a very balanced place, you know, that's a philosophically based place. We come in here and we get a structure that really allows us to be free.
Hello and welcome to Making School Matter, where we dive into the science of teaching and learning and how it's transforming education today. As more teachers and school leaders discover the power of understanding how learners make meaning and how creating the right environment can help them thrive, the more this informs our everyday practices. On this show, I sit down with educators and school leaders who are bringing brain science to life in their school and classrooms, using practical strategies and making learning more engaging, responsive, and making school matter for every student. Today's episode is especially powerful. We're joined by two Detroit Country Day School alumni from the class of 1974, whose lives and work speak deeply to the heart of our school's mission. Harry Davis is the director of the NAACP-nominated documentary Fast Dreams, a 17-year journey chronicling the life of Olympic gold medalist Bianca Knight. The film weaves together themes of perseverance, identity, and the pursuit of excellence. And it's already resonated with our students who watched it and reflected deeply in our advisories. Bill Snyder, continuing the work of Etienne Wegner, is the co-author of Cultivating Communities of Practice, a seminal work of how people learn together, build meaning together, and foster belonging inside organizations, schools, and beyond. Together, these amazing alumni of the DCDS graduating class of 1974 invite us to think about how stories shape identity, how communities sustain effort, and how education can uplift not only individuals, but entire communities. As we explore the intersections of storytelling, leadership, and school legacy, we also reflect on how Detroit Country Day School can continue becoming the community it aspires to be, one that values service, character, rigor, expression, and inclusion. Harry and Bill, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, for sure.
Thanks, Mike.
Appreciate you.
Yeah. Harry, 17 years is a remarkable commitment to one film. What inspired you to begin Fast Dreams, and what kept you going through the ups and downs of such a long production journey?
Okay, I would say there's probably like three elements that inspired me. One, you know, I ran track, right? So it shaped my life. It was very valuable to me. So I wanted to give back to the sport. All right, number two, I, you know, coming from a co-ed sport, you know, like tennis or swimming, track and field, it kind of shows you that the women and men are actually equal in terms of, you know, performance, and they could actually be the most popular in the world, you know. So it's not like how they got it in, say, other sports like basketball, where the men's sport, you have all these stories about the athletes, and you'll have athletes who retire, they get endorsements, they retire, they get announcing jobs, and then there's statues built about them. And I didn't see that with the women. You know, you don't see stories about their journey. You don't see the statues about them. You don't see all that. So I said, if the media would cover women, then it would equalize the playing field between women and men, and you would start to see the same kind of, like Rudy, a story like Rudy. You know, we need a story like that about a woman athlete. So that was something that was in my mind. And then I guess the trigger point was, you know, Bianca being this young 12 or 13-year-old who was, you know, lighting up the track world. And I followed track. I followed the youth, and I know, like, all the youth who are coming up. So when I saw that, you know, I said, wow, it would be great. You know, there were a few people like her, and I said it would be great to do a story on somebody like that, and that would really tell the story that make the point that I'm trying to make. So luckily, I ran into somebody who was Bianca's cousin, and I said, well, if that's your cousin, call her. Called her, I spoke to her, I said, I'm gonna do a movie about you. Let me speak to your mother. So that's how it all started. But it didn't go as planned. You know what I mean? This journey, this 17-year journey, or me picking Bianca and she wins the gold medal, it didn't really go like that. It was kind of accidental, how it turned into all that. I mean, it's a great story, but it was just kind of by happenstance. You know, I was filming her, then I'm filming a whole bunch of other people, then I luckily stumbled back, you know, to film her. And then I couldn't find an ending to the story. So because of that, it extended the time that I'm shooting, you know, until so that's really how it happened.
Sometimes that kind of serendipitous right. approach to things often comes out with a really incredible product.
Right.
Yeah. Great film. We watched it in an assembly and really left us thinking about big ideas. So, Bill, I have read the first book, Communities of Practice, in my graduate studies, thinking about social constructivism and the way in which we interpret the world and make meaning of the world around us. Interested in your contribution to cultivating communities of practice. Can you share a bit about your contribution and how it helps us think differently about learning, not as something individuals do alone, but how we do this together?
Well, Etienne Wenger, who wrote The Communities of Practice, the original thesis of, you know, how do we learn in community and how important community is a contrast to thinking of learning as happening in very structured environments, and that's the way that we should be organizing, controlling, and structuring the curriculum and what people learn and how they learn it. And so his work from sort of ethnographic sort of perspective was, if we look at where a lot of expertise and skill and really creative perspective on subjects comes from, a lot of it happens informally in the context of relationships. And it's not just with a mentor. Often the guru is a person who helps coalesce a group of people where a lot of the learning is happening peer-to-peer, and a lot of it is happening in informal spaces. So where Etienne and I met, it was also informal. I had been doing research on organizations because I was in getting a PhD in organization theory and thinking about, I was interested in how did transformation happen in organizations, in part because I was interested really in how does transformation happen in society and looking at large organizations as a kind of petri dish for figuring out what the dynamics are in terms of participation, learning, innovation, transformation at individual, group, and larger levels. Etienne's the seminal theoretician and philosopher. I had been working in organizations in terms of how do you apply these principles of engagement, in innovation, and doing that in participatory ways that involve people on the front line, not just in the executive suite. And so I was interested in how do we take these ideas about social learning and the importance of informal context and adding intentionality to that in real life. So part of the, you know, the theory of communities of practice is not only are we not doing all our learning in the structured parts of our classes or our training experiences, we're learning in the informal spaces. We're learning after the class as the students are coming up to the professor, and they're not just coming up alone, they're coming up with their friends or whatever and saying, you know, wait a minute. If this idea is true, why isn't it being applied in this case? And they're going back and forth professor, and they're starting to come up with, okay, so there's a gap in the theory, so what would we do about it? And then they're connecting with their friend or a couple friends, and they're thinking, well, what could we do together? I mean, you know, what is there some books or articles that we should be reading and talking about? Is there a research project? I'm talking now about graduate students, et cetera. If I think about the research that we've done and the applications we did in organizations on communities of practice, and organizations were paying for it because they were getting, and this is in the 90s, much more conscious of the power of talent, of getting the best talent, for the kinds of disciplines that organizations have to do well to succeed, and realizing that if they wanted to promote innovation and get on that kind of hockey stick growth curve in terms of product development, market penetration, they were going to have dissemination of ideas and expertise accelerate. And the way to do that was to cultivate the personal relationships of the people who were going to share those ideas, share those failures, and help each other, you know, try a new idea that may have been, you know, controversial or face a lot of skepticism from upper management, but make it happen. So being here at Country Day and coming back has been a way of sort of cueing me into our communities. I mean, you know, Harry Davis, David Honigman, me sort of, you know, being in class, being in history class, let's say with Mr. Ogden, learning about European history And, you know, we're using the game diplomacy to help us learn more about the kind of strategic, you know, game theory kind of applications. We didn't talk about it that way then. But we kept playing that game. I mean, outside of class, we were fascinated with the sort of the framing that Mr. Ogden had done. And then we were participating in the learning outside of class. And it was because we had those kind of relationships, that friendship. And it wasn't just the three of us. It was other students. We were creating a social context for learning and getting a sense of our own personal interests and passion in this, you know, on this topic. And so that, you know, you're learning not only about the topic, you're learning about your own interest in the topic and to what extent this is a passion for you from doing the experience. Yeah.
Yeah. Learning is a very emotional and individual part of living, although social constructivism says that we learn better when we are able to share our experiences with others. Mm-hmm. But to do so, you have to bring all of your own lived experiences to that. Yeah. And sometimes that's a vulnerable place to be. Mm-hmm. And you're caught in this kind of like cognitive dissonance. Mm-hmm. And you have to share that with others in order to build your understanding and do that with other people who can help you along the way. I know that in the documentary, Fast Dreams, there are deeply emotional and vulnerable moments in the film. How did you build the kind of trust with Bianca and her family that allowed those scenes to unfold?
By turning the camera off. That's really it. Like, you know, thinking about the humanity of the people in the situation more so than what I was trying to accomplish. So a lot of times early on, there were situations where, you know, I knew how crushed or hurt Bianca was or how upset she was or how upset the family was. And I knew I needed those moments for the documentary. But at the same time, I knew to take it easy, you know, cut the camera off, let them do what they got to do. And also I was concerned with, you know, portraying, you know, like you may have a bad day, like Bianca, for example, but that day was going to resonate in the film a lot larger than, you know, that day really existed in her life. So if I film that day, it might be a great moment that you see kind of on reality TV, but it still would destroy, you know, the understand, you know, the audience's understanding of who Bianca was. It would loom so large in the film. You would use it if you shot it. So I just started turning the camera off at certain times, and then that, you know, of course, missing moments like that makes the film longer, because you got to still find that information, but you got to find it another way. Another thing was I dealt with her mother more so than her, because I knew I'm dealing with a young lady, you know. So I said, let me establish a relationship with her mother, and then I worked through her mother, which made it once again harder, you know, because sometimes I think if you do things the right way, it's just a longer way. You know what I mean? Because you're not taking the obvious shortcut. You know, you say, well, I'll get it some other way, but that's going to take more time. It's going to take more in-depth conversation. You know, so that for me, it was turning the camera off and then dealing with her mother. And I will also say this. You got willing participants like Bianca. Bianca, she understood the moment just like I did, and her mother did. She was not a subject who was like, I had to cajole, you know, to do this film. She wanted to do it just as much as I did. Like, she understood that, wow, people could see, have some insight into what I'm going through that would mean something to them. So she gave, you know, just like I received. You know, at the same time, her mother was the same way. So, I mean, I give them credit that during the process, they wanted this to make this film just as much as I did.
Yeah, connecting that to the idea of education, turning the camera off is like going into formative assessment. That's something personal between you and the learner. That's not anything that's for a grade. Right. It's not anything that is public facing. It's just the learning experience of getting feedback. When you turn the camera on, then that's that summative assessment, right? That's what you get graded on. That's what gets put on Canvas, passed on to the next teacher, or put on your transcript for college. And it is a trust-building part from teacher to student. When you have that individual interaction with the formative assessment, then when you get the feedback and apply it to your learning, and then when you do have that summative assessment, that's the application, and that's that the film that you capture, right? And I know that there is a lot of importance put on the idea of formative assessment. So, Bill, I wonder, what is the importance of building that trust in cultivating communities of practice?
It's kind of what makes a community of practice distinctive when worth participating in. I mean, you have people who want to learn together. Well, we could be software engineers or people, you know, who are marketing professionals, or it could be people who are consultants working in organizations to help them transform. And if they're going to, or can be teachers in a school who are working with, you know, students every day who are growing up. And so there's a curriculum that they're teaching, and all there's also a curriculum of the students who are both learning the topic and growing up. And there's a lot of intersection between those two kinds of curriculum. Teachers trying to make sense of that while they're participating, while they're online every day in the classroom, talking with their peers about that experience, what they're learning and what they're struggling with. That's where the social trust is crucial, because you're not going to have any conversation about, speaking about being vulnerable, about the struggle that you're having in a classroom, especially high achievement, you know, school like Country Day. You have to trust that the other people are going to listen with empathy, with interest, that they care, that when they respond, they're also going to be open about the experience they've had that's like that. And then in the responses, not just assume that, you know, they've got a solution for you, but that they're trying out ideas with you, that you're there participating with you in learning how to improve the practice in the classroom, and also integrate that personally in terms of what that means in terms of the growth of your professional growth, or some of the edge that you're playing with in terms of, let's say, being vulnerable in front of the students about not knowing everything about this topic. Is that okay about this topic? Is that okay? Is it okay to lean on some of these students are amazing, you know, on students' ideas to get a new perspective on a topic that you've been teaching for 10 years? That's the kind of, I mean, there's a lot of sort of edges of vulnerability that teachers might experience and wonder about in terms of to what extent participating with the students about how to shape the curriculum and how to foster learning, peer-to-peer learning among the students. Being able to have a community, it doesn't have to be all the teachers in your discipline, doesn't have to be all teachers at Country Bay, but sort of finding what is my kind of core community and how do we establish that kind of willingness to, and part of it is just making the time for each other. So that's saying, you know, I need this once a month where we get together for a couple hours and talk about, do what we used to call case clinic, where one of us may just sort of present an experience that we had where we've got some questions about our own competence. We've got some questions about whether something we're trying is working, whether someone else has done it, and we need some help. And that's where that relational kind of trust is, you know, really the foundation for those kinds of conversations and the learning that can come from them.
You brought up a couple of things that really made me think. You know, I'm steeped in Project Zero's Creating Cultures of Thinking, the work of Ron Richhart and Mark Church. And one of the concepts you were talking about is taking time.
Mm.
Building a culture takes time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's one of the cultural forces that I'm always aware of. It's a depleting commodity. You can't create more time.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that disappears as you go. Mm-hmm. So it's the way we marshal time that creates that culture.
Mm-hmm.
What we value is what we spend our time on, right? You can say that I value creating a culture of thinking or communities of practice, but if we only spend time in the classroom memorizing dates and facts and recalling them on a multiple choice quiz, that's a silent way of showing what you value in your classroom. You can say one thing, but the way that you spend your time is sending that message. Another one that you had talked about is being okay with saying, I just don't know. Even as the teacher, we have to have that vulnerability to say, I'm not sure. Let's talk about some things. And Jessica Vance was on my podcast last episode talking about that same thing, that we have to model cognitive apprenticeship and model how we gain knowledge or model that inquiry process to the students in our classroom. Yes, as teachers, we are the lead learners in the classroom. We don't know everything, but we have to be able to model for our thinkers that the teacher doesn't know everything, and then how we go about making meaning of the things we don't know yet. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a really important element to talk about. And one of your book's key insights, Bill, is that learning can happen even on the periphery mm-hmm. before mm-hmm. it becomes mastery.
Mm-hmm.
And so can you elaborate on that concept?
Well, I mean, there is the canon, you know, the sort of, this is what we know in this field. And it, let's say it could be, you know, one of the topics I was interested in at Country Day was, you know, what's the canon about how monies, how companies make money in a capitalist context, and to what extent is that wealth shared equitably in society, and to what extent are companies committed to both the economic benefits to their shareholders and committed to the broader stakeholder sort of community. Now that's there's a lot of controversial elements in all of that. And I think that the canon in, let's say in the case of learning economic theory, may be very well established, but on the periphery, people who are interested in the topic but aren't sure whether they have a commitment to learning the canon and becoming an expert, I'm going to become a professor in economic theory or whatever, I'm on the periphery maybe in a couple ways. I don't understand the canon. I'm not sure I'm committed to that canon. I'm actually interested in a competing perspective on it. And so I don't have the kind of legitimacy that the people who are the current expertise, they have the current expertise, the current sort of reputation and brand for that discipline. So where is my legitimacy going to come from? I may participate intermittently in, you know, certain kinds of courses, write some papers in showing that I can learn what the established knowledge is. But in the meantime, I may be participating with people who are more on the margins. Maybe their ideas and perspectives aren't yet considered legitimate, and to what extent do we start to build a new center of excellence, a new sort of domain area for coalescing our shared interest in exploring together, you know, what is a social theory of organizations that would encourage them to think about that sort of broader impact on society? That's sort of where new ideas come from. It's when the people who are on the periphery start to connect and realize that they've got an idea that has value but isn't yet recognized and start to take it seriously. And it's very hard to do by yourself if you're out there as a lone voice. And part of the value of communities of practice is creating a context where you run into people like the way Etienne and I met each other. Because in those days, communities of practice, I was writing my dissertation. And my dissertation advisor said, I don't want you to include this in your dissertation about organization learning and knowledge. This is a crazy idea, crazy term. The communities of practice just sounds, what's practice? Why communities? And you're talking about organizations. And so it was people like Etienne and others that I got to connect with to say, no, this is a really important perspective on learning and innovations in the leading, you know, organizations, businesses around the world, and we need to take it seriously for them to look into it. And, you know, it took another 5 years, and my that same dissertation advisor was saying, Bill, you're one of the, you know, one of the graduates that we're most proud of that came through our program. So that was a, you know, kind of full cycle thing. And then they're telling students, future PhD students, hey, this guy Snyder came through the program. He ended up doing this research on learning in organizations. He helped co-develop this notion of communities of practice, which is now, you know, there's like 15,000 academic citations of that book. And, you know, so it's, you know, become a success story. But in the beginning, we were on the periphery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Bill,
yeah.
You had mentioned before the importance of reflection.
Mm-hmm.
And Jessica Vance talked about how important reflection is in teaching with an inquiry stance.
Mm-hmm.
And I go back to the idea from John Dewey. He says, we don't learn from experience. We learn from reflecting upon that experience, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Harry, how might Bianca have applied the idea of reflection in her early years as an athlete, learning by watching, by failing, by listening, before stepping into the spotlight?
I think in Bianca's early years, I mean, it was she was kind of moving by rote in a way. Like, she's more talented than the rest, right? So a lot of times when you're the person who's more talented than the rest, you don't really think about or reflect on what you're doing. You just do it, right? A lot of times you see these athletes or musicians that just don't even, can't even replicate what they're doing.
It's muscle memory.
Yes, yeah. Yep. They can't even tell. They can't teach another person how to do it because they're just capable of doing it. So I think in the early years, you know, that's what Bianca was doing. She didn't have to start reflecting until she started running against people who were right next to her, you know. So now, and that was a problem. When she was in the Olympic trials in 2008 and came around that turn and looked up and saw that everybody was right there, she hesitated. You know what I mean? Like, she didn't take that next step, and she lost, you know, and that began the process of reflection on her part. Now, that process didn't stop with, you know, her, oh, okay, I'm reflecting now, I'm learning. No, she went backwards. You know what I mean? Like, a lot of times when you start, like Bill saying, you start reflecting, you start learning, you know, things that are actually blocking you from improving. Like, you have to go through a process, maybe building a different construct about how to proceed. And in that short career, she never did apply that, you know what I mean? Like, build a new structure and create a process that worked for her. She didn't, you know.
Harry, when I think about the film, because I joined you, you invited me to come down and ended up being her last race
right.
in Boston. And you were filming her on the way back to the hotel, and you're filming her life, as it were. She's embodying this whole, you know, experience of being a runner and all that. And I'm wondering if you being there and doing the filming wasn't like creating a context for her to either implicitly or explicitly do more reflection than she would have done otherwise. And so I'm thinking here at Country Day, you know, the podcast studio or the films that students are doing isn't just a cue to say, let's reflect on our experience. I mean, they may not framing it just like that, but in many cases, that could be, you know, creating a kind of scaffolding for inquiring what is our experience about and how right. are we feeling about it and what does it mean, and doing it in a setting where that's legitimate. It's kind of taken for granted that you're going to be, you know, witnessing or simulating, or, you know, when you do a skit, sort of acting out what is it like to be a student here at Country Day, trying to, like we were doing at the end of the semester, trying to do those last two papers and prepare right. prepare for that last test, and what kind of a toll does that take, you know, physically, psychologically, and to what extent do we depend on each other? And in the context of doing a short documentary about that, or however you do it, learning more about how much we do depend on each other, learning more about what we could do to help balance our lives in a way, kind of reflection we might not have done otherwise.
That's an important point, because a lot of times, like you said, when you're doing like a film or a snapshot, you're doing a podcast or whatever, you want it to be perfect. You want to get the answer. You want to do the thinking and figure it out. But I think like what Billy's saying is that, you know, just starting the process of reflecting, you really may not come up with the answer, but now you're thinking about it. And I'm thinking, like, for all of us, like the filmmaker, the subjects, all of us are thinking about it. And like what you said, like from the filmmaker standpoint, we're backing off of, we're making ourselves small, like the teacher, you know what I mean? In order to allow the thinking to happen. And then we're thinking about it and exploring at the same time. So it's really a process where everybody involved is thinking. And I say to students or you know, like filmmakers or whatever, don't require yourself to get the answer. Because, you know, like many things, when you start thinking about it, you want to come up with something, but you don't always come up with something. But the process of thinking about it is important enough. Years later, after you see the piece and say, you know what, I really know now where I was going with that. But you got to be okay with where you are. You know what I mean? I can only get this far right now. You know. So.
And building that persistence, and building that perseverance and the resilience through trying something and maybe it didn't come out the way you wanted it to that first time or the second time. But by the time you've practiced that skill with new content, you have finally found something that you're proud of, but it may not be your first try, may not be your third try. So you have to think about how to persevere through some of those things. So Bianca perseveres through injuries, through competition, through loss, and systemic challenges. Bill, I wonder, how does resilience emerge not just from individual grit, but from being a part of a community that shares that knowledge and shares that support?
You know, in that, let's say it's a group of students here at Country Day. Let's say it's, you know, 4, 5, 6 people who are maybe most closely, intimately connected. And then there's a kind of periphery socially. There may be friends of each of those 4 or 5 that sort of in and out, depending on the activity, whether it's on a team or in a class or in the commons room. And I, you know, any one of those 4, 5, 6, or 7 may be feeling a particular crisis or a particular challenge or in a personal quandary of some kind. Not likely they're all going through the same thing unless there's some, you know, some kind of a crisis in the school where they're all experiencing it. But just the sense of, okay, one of us needs a little more support now. And one of us at the lunch table is going to talk more than the others. Or in the conference room, in the commons room, one of us may sort of reach out and go sit down. I mean, maybe I have some paper I'm supposed to be preparing for, but I'm going to take some time out and sit down with. You may sit down with me and say, Billy, I know that you're disappointed because you're injured. You're not going to be able to, you know, wrestle in that tournament. Just wanted to check in with you. How are you doing? And that can mean so much that somebody sees you. Somebody, even if you're not on the team, you appreciate, you know, as an athlete what it's like. You wanted to be on that in that tournament, and it's going to go by, and you're not going to be able to participate. And just knowing from a peer who knows exactly what you're going through can mean a lot. And then there's a month later, whatever, Harry's working on a paper, and he's thinking about the topic, but he doesn't know whether it's going to write about this or about that. And he feels that it's okay in our relationship to say it. And it could be, back in the day, it would be David and I who might be sitting around just sort of saying, well, you know, why are you even thinking about that? I mean, we start joking about it. And then out of that conversation, it's a sense that you've got friends that you can share where you're at. There's somebody to talk to, and you're not alone going through this. And you're building the capacity for resilience not only in yourself, but in your understanding of how to connect with others to help steward that resilience together. The resilience never belongs or is, you know, established and owned in one's individual psychology. It's always, I mean, one way to talk about it was just to call it social resilience. And to talk about grit as social grit, because underneath the hood, it's the way it's happening is because people are able to depend on each other. And even when, let's say, you're not there, Harry,
right.
I know that you could be there. So I'm almost having that conversation between us in my head. You're there. I'm experiencing that social relationship even by myself, because I know we've had those conversations before, we'll have them again. And that resilience that I'm feeling, you might call individual resilience, is actually a social resilience.
You know, I like to think, you know, and building on what Billy's saying is, that maybe take the finality out of things sometimes. You know what I mean? Like, you know, a lot of things we do, there's a project that we're doing, it's going to be completed by this date, and that's going to be final. This is it, you know. And you sometimes make the mistake, you don't realize that I am growing as I'm doing this project or the next project or the next project. So is it, where is the finality in that? Like, if I'm gonna grow, if I'm thinking about my life as a whole, then maybe what I think is final, maybe that's an external, you know, like that's externally applied, like the finality, like the dates, like maybe it's not final. Maybe that's not the date. Maybe that's not when I'm supposed to finish it. I'm learning, I'm growing. So I'm going to let the project be fluid, You know what I mean? And I'm and now it's going to continue to grow. And then I will get it sooner or later, you know, or whoever's involved, we will get it sooner or later. And then it'll create its own finality, like communities of practice. Mm-hmm. Like all of a sudden, now you've got a new discipline, and now 15,000 times it's been cited because the world caught up, you know, and they got it. They realized that this is something we have to do. You know what I mean? So I think that even for these for the students here, the element of finality exists when grading, you know, your goals and the papers due. But separate the students, maybe separate themselves from that. Yeah, you have to do it, but don't judge yourself completely by it because you're growing, you're learning, you're continuing.
And when we talk about creating something new and sharing that with others, we have the publication Cultivating Communities of Practice. We have the documentary Fast Dreams. You are sharing a bit about yourself and telling a story to others, especially spaces like this podcast studio or our XR studio. It's a space for learners to come and share something with others. And Danielle Karmanis shares the importance of storytelling in these spaces. And so we are these storytellers and we share things with others. So the Cultivating Communities of Practice also highlights the importance of storytelling in meaning making. Mm-hmm. So, Harry, how did the long arc of Bianca's story help build this shared understanding? And how might schools use narrative to strengthen learning communities?
Well, in this particular case, you know, I think it's the collab between myself and Billy, right? Because, you know, I'm thinking a part of it, which is, okay, this is a film. It could be used as a vehicle, you know, for like, okay, I look at it this way. You got education that's competing with technology, you know, that's competing with entertainment, you know, probably on the phone that's in the kids' hands, you know. So education has to collab with technology and entertainment in order to keep these kids' attention, right? In my case, I said, well, film's a good place to start with that. You know, like a film can be a vehicle that's offered to education, and I think of it as a primary distribution market, not secondary, you know, like Hollywood, and now we'll go to the schools. No, I think the primary distribution, you know, market will be education, right, for entertainment content. And then what that does is that makes entertainment content have to rise to the level of being able, you know, for academics to be able to see something in it and to be able to fit within that, you know, that paradigm of, you know, how the whatever the rubric is, how the teachers are going to teach, right? So in my case, Billy, having done what he's done, you know, and having taught me so much, communities of practice and all, what I see is a collaboration where I'm bringing the film to the table and saying, oh, loosely, this thing, you know, could contribute, be a big vehicle and help the kids learn. Then Billy took it from there with his work and said, well, this is how that might happen. You know what I mean? This is the mechanics of it. And this is how it can extend itself, you know, beyond just that film.
You know, what would be interesting is, you know, can't remember the author, a Yale professor, wrote a book called Tell Me a Story. He was originally a big prophet for AI. This is the original form of AI going back in the 80s and 90s, which really failed. What his research ended up saying was the most contextualized knowledge for the people who are most advanced in a field, most expert, whatever, whether it's a professor or whether it's software engineer, or, you know, whether it's a marketing professional, they, if they're going to share their latest, most expert craft experience, it's going to be in the context of a story. And part of what I'm thinking about, Harry, is the students have seen Fast Dreams. They've been in the advisory circles where they've talked about their questions for you. You've responded not only about talking about Bianca, but your own story as a filmmaker. And so I'm wondering, you know, one of the students came after, she didn't get to ask her question in the assembly, but she came up to you afterwards and her question was, how do you feel about failure? What's your experience of failure? And what does that mean to you? And I just thought it was because, and then your response to her, the first thing was, it's all about failure. And I was so fascinated with where would that conversation go. And what I'm thinking now is, you could take, now go to the next level and say, okay, we've talked about Bianca's story, we've talked about the filmmaker's story, Harry Davis's story, let's talk about our own stories. How does this experience cue us to share a story for that girl who is, I think, one of the a really good athlete here at Country Day?
Right.
Talk about her experience of being on the field sometimes, you know, when feeling disappointment, feeling like it was her responsibility for not making that goal. She had a wide open shot. Let's talk about it. Tell us the story of what that, how that happened, what the context was, how you were feeling afterwards. Who did you talk to afterwards? How are you feeling about it now? When you think about now with a little bit of perspective, you know, what is it that you've learned from it?
It's such a warm invitation.
Yeah.
Such
a
warm invitation to students to reflect on their own experiences through the story that they've just been told, and a really great way of, you know, opening that door to, well, I didn't think that my story was worth sharing until I saw the film and until I was asked questions about it. And now you have this platform and you have a drive, a direction to, you're compelled to share your own story through the lens of Bianca, through the lens of that story.
You know, just thinking about the practice of coaching. You know, we've got some great coaches. We had some great coaches
great
at
coaches.
Country Day. But in this case, you're extending what is the practice of coaching, because you're saying, let's invite the students to tell stories about how they feel before a championship. And you're getting new layers of context in the Country Day context, in the context of these students, about how does it feel to be preparing for a championship, whatever it is, tournament, whatever sport. And maybe now making more explicit, what do we do when we're prospective, when we're preparing for some of our big matches or our big games.
Right.
And I'm also thinking about the practice of teaching and including and incorporating more explicitly the I didn't know what I was doing, or I wasn't sure, I'm still not sure how to introduce this new perspective on a topic that I'm actually not quite expert at. And I'm kind of actually afraid that one of the students in our class knows more about it than me.
Right.
And starting to legitimize, kind of opening up the practice of teaching as a practice in, you know, co-learning, whatever you want to call it, that the students as well as the teachers are seeing themselves as responsible for stewarding.
Right.
And, you know, to the extent that, you know, after class when they're doing math homework together, they're realizing they're not just trying to get through this, you know, homework together. They're actually participating in the practice of learning and teaching. And what did we learn about how we do homework together?
Right. And understanding why numeracy is so important to you.
Yeah, and like you said, you're extending that story. It starts in sports. What? Mens sana et corpore sano, right?
So mind and sound body.
So yes. It starts in sports where you have that kind of reflective piece, you know, with her, you know, through the championship season. But then the next time, it's the kids that are doing the genome research with Stanford.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're in the same kind of storytelling about, like you said, they're approaching what they're trying to do, and they're having the same struggles and problems. So we extend it beyond the athletic field into other areas, like what you're saying, and people are seeing how what sound mind and sound body really means.
As we wrap up, I would like for us to engage in our own reflective practice, connecting mission, our own practices, and our lived experiences. So Detroit Country Day's mission emphasizes academic rigor, competitive athletics, artistic expression, service, and character. So how did your own school experience shape the paths that you took?
Well, I think, you know, we had, okay, so the sports thing was a given. I mean, you're going to participate in teams, and you get an opportunity to choose from a lot of options.
And there was a three-sport
retirement expectation.
Yeah.
And the academics, again, a lot of options, a lot of rigor, a lot of support for that. I think in terms of the service work, we also had experience of that. I mean, the tutoring that we did, that some of us did when going downtown, there was the experience. It wasn't quite service, but one of our history teachers encouraged us, Mayor Coleman Young was running for mayor back in those days, and he was the first black candidate for mayor. He ended up winning. We were out in the neighborhoods doing canvassing. I mean, you know, we're 17 years old, never participated in anything political, but because we were encouraged to try that and supported it for doing it, we did, you know, sort of unprecedented experience for us. And then, so if I think about the service, I think about the academics, about the athletics, and thinking about in terms of character development, I don't know that it was always explicit, but some of us who were on a Zoom call recently, you know, reflecting back 50 years on our high school experience, were remembering times when we did something, a coach or a teacher was seeing it, and it was a teaching moment. You know, one of us was talking, I was on the wrestling team, and one of our teammates was in a match, and the opponent wasn't that good. It was at a rival school that, you know, we real definitely wanted to beat. He picked the guy up, fireman's carry, lifted himself up over his shoulders, twirled him around, and then brought him down on the mat, was smiling while I did it, finished the match. He's going over to the water fountain, and Gene Riley, one of the coaches and teachers at Country Day, comes up to him and says, "You're better than that." And the student in this case said, "You know what? That was for me an experience of a teacher caring and seeing, and it totally resonated. I knew immediately that he was right." And it was, for him, a really profound experience in terms of character development. Now, when we take that experience and we go off to, in Harry's case, go off to Yale, go off to Harvard, and, you know, we're continuing our interests in athletics. I was on the wrestling team there. You were on the track team, became captain of the track team. In academics, I was inspired here by my history professor, history teacher, Mr. Campbell, and the interest in sociology, social psychology, and how it casts new perspective on the workplace and society more broadly. I pursued that. And I also, from the experiences on the teams and the experiences going out and campaigning or going out and participating in the Great Boycott or doing the tutoring, I felt like, you know, that's a dimension of experience where I now feel not confident, but I feel practiced. I feel like I've done that. I can do that again. So there was a poster at Harvard that said, "You have an opportunity for go teach an alternative school down in the city." And usually you're in this cloistered environment on campus. And I thought, hey, I've done some of that. I'm going to try that. And that was added a whole new dimension to my experience at Harvard. And so and it's just some examples of how the experience of Country Day sort of created a template, created some expectations, created a sense of self-efficacy and doing things that I never would have thought about before. And so that when I landed at Harvard, I thought, okay, I see the opportunity and I see what I might get out of it. So I'm going to try it.
Yeah, I think from my side, Country Day, okay, let's look at the times. You know, when is the last time that everything in the country was as polarized? You know, like probably the 60s, you know, as you can kind of see now, right? And here we come right after the 60s, growing up in the 60s, but here we are in the 70s. The kind of like the beneficiaries of all that. We didn't have to choose sides, right? We were the younger kids of the people who did have to choose sides. So we were able to see all the sides that were chosen, and we were still not having to make those choices, right? So then you come to Country Day. Sound practices, like I say, sound mind and sound body, balanced practices, play three sports. You know what I mean? Like, you're good in one, but you're bad at another one. So guess what? You're going to learn humility along with learning how to be great, right? Sound practices academically, very good professors who care, a philosophical underpinning, you know, of what the school is about. So here we come after the 60s, seeing how everybody had made choices and coming into a very balanced place, you know, that's a philosophically based place where it's been thought about. We come in here and we get a structure that really allows us to be free, actually protects us, right? And then here we are now, 50 years later, where we're now back in a period, you know, where the country's polarized. And I just feel like we were an experiment, right? And Country Day was an experiment. And it's all grown up, right? So that Country Day is here today. And then it's also time for us to answer the experiment. Like, how did it turn out? You know what I mean? So I think our generation and our time and the time that we met Country Day is all pivotal, now. You know, it's important now. Because I think these kids now are in that 68, 69, where they have to make a choice. And the kids who come after will be like us, where it's like, we saw that, we stayed out of it, and we learned from it.
Well, Bill and Harry, I want to thank you for spending your time and sharing your stories, very powerful stories. And I want to congratulate you both on a happy 50th anniversary.
Thank you.
And I would like to think that this is just a beginning of a longer partnership. And thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate you. Love what you're doing. Appreciate what you're doing. Keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you.
All right.
On behalf of everyone at Detroit Country Day School, thank you for listening to the Making School Matter podcast, powered by the studios at DCDS. If you enjoyed our time together, please like, share, and subscribe. For more episodes, you can find us on all the popular podcast sites. And for more information on our alumni or to learn more about Detroit Country Day School, please visit dcds.edu. Until next time, I'm your host, Mike Medvinsky, and I encourage you to look closely, think deeply, and wonder incessantly.